once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And somebody asked me to say, and I keep forgetting to do this, to tell the date so they'll know whether we're live or dead. I mean, dead is the opposite of live, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
And if this is Saturday, April 19th, in the year of our Lord, 2014, this is a live radio presentation, and you can call in, and we will actually discuss things with you, I hope. 773-1400 or?
1-866-597-1400.
We got lots of stuff to talk about. What do we want to talk about?
Well, I wanted to kind of wrap another piece up.
Oh, you're going to wrap.
Right. No. We're really bad at wrapping. So
really?
What I will do is I will wind up. How's that? No, now I'm pitching.
Right. You're going to make a pitch.
Last hour, we ended talking about the commons and the plight thereof, and we were talking about welfare, and we were talking about these concepts of how do we improve society in the future with what we have to work with today when our politicians are building their election campaign for a year or 2 years from now, not 20 years from now.
Easy solution. Bill the Butcher, speaking to Henry V after he was crowned king, said the first thing we need to do is kill all the lawyers.
Except that then our society would grind to a halt.
Okay.
That's a minor problem.
Okay.
This is something that...
I'm sure Ed Laughlin would not appreciate
no,
that.
No, he would be upset a little bit. He would say, well, I thought you liked me. We do. He's a great guy.
He is.
We wouldn't want him to be.
Yeah, we'd make an exception.
Bill the Butcher would
right.
make an exception for him. Right.
Right.
There is another fellow that wrote some pretty interesting stuff in the middle of being completely insane, who also won a Nobel Prize in economics, that dealt with this. John Nash.
Oh, yes. Well, he wasn't completely insane. He was just mostly insane.
Yeah, well, by mostly insane, he was completely insane.
Well, yeah. Well, so
he was not able to deal with society at all. That's what most people would be institutionalized. He was institutionalized.
Stanford.
Okay, so the concepts that we're talking about, how do we deal with this competition for fish or for intellect or for anything else? And the way we've dealt with it throughout human history is we compete harder. If there's not enough fish to go around, then we grab as many of those fish as we can.
Right.
That doesn't work.
Unfortunately, that winds up with the fish becoming extinct.
Right. What John Nash said to do, and for those of you who don't know who he is, the movie A Beautiful Mind was loosely based on his life.
Mm-hmm. Very loosely.
Very, very loosely. All of the emotional parts of that were completely different. His psychoses or neuroticisms were completely different. All of it. Basically, he was involved in some math. That's where it's the same. And he made some big moves.
Crazy guy who had delusions who got a Nobel Prize.
Right. That's what Hollywood said. All right, there you go. And
that much was true.
Jennifer Connelly is a lot prettier than anybody that he probably dated. So I think in the end it was fine. And he was played by the Gladiator. So it's all good there as far as the movie goes.
Yeah, he's not quite as good looking.
No, but the concept that he developed, it's called game theory, and it's this concept of, for those of you who have the time or the inclination, look up the Prisoner's Dilemma, or there's a lot of concepts that sprung out of what he was talking about. When we know what benefits us and what hurts us in the long run, we still tend to make the wrong decision, unless we know we tend to make the wrong decision. And up till now in human history, we make these decisions. That's true in the market. We make these decisions thinking, I'm going to get out of the market. It's down. When that's the worst decision you can make at that point, getting out of the market because it's up is a great decision. Getting out of the market because the market is down is horrible.
The problem is compounded by the fact that you really never know whether it's up or down.
Correct.
Until after the fact.
Right. And basically what he's saying is if you define the environment, and you look around at the other people involved in the environment, who's going, we're talking about fish in the ocean, if there's a lot of tuna out there, but if everybody goes out and takes as many tuna as they want, there's not going to be any tuna left. If you define everybody involved, and you begin by saying, all right, why are we after tuna to begin with? Well, we like tuna. Okay, are there other fish that we like? Yes. Let's start talking about cooperation in how we get the tuna. Now, that leaves out the fact that sometimes you have these maniacs out there. We've got them in North Korea. We've got them. They're hanging around the world maniacking. They're running around doing very strange things. But the concept here is if we discuss and cooperate in certain fashions, it implements our competition in a way that causes the best results. It's basically what we do as Americans in our businesses. We're competing with each other, but we have ground rules that say if you use unfair competition, we're going to shut you down.
Who's the we? It's the government.
The government. Well, right. The government is the we. We are the government.
We just, the people of the United States of America?
Right, exactly.
Yes.
We need to recognize that we are the government. We need to recognize the fact that we as the people have a longer time horizon than the next election cycle of the politicians.
Well, we do.
It's amazing, I know, but we do need to recognize that.
I have trouble seeing it. It's hard to recognize it
most
if you
people,
can't find it.
Most people can't see more than a week or two in advance.
That's a big stretch for some people.
That's the vast majority of people. Some small amount of people can see a month in advance, and very, very few people look a year in advance. We're talking about 20 years. It's when you look at all these statistics about government retirement systems failing, Social Security or Medicare, which has been improved quite a lot by Obamacare, but it still has a lot of problems. Welfare, you look at retirement from the military. All of these things are true problems, but they're not problems now. They're going to be problems in 10 years or 20 years. So they're not on anybody's agenda.
But they're easy to fix now and it'll be very hard to fix then.
Exactly.
But we, and I think there's a legitimate reason, it sounds irrational that we would not be acting to fix them today. But in another sense, and this is an area I'm digging into, in another sense, it's not irrational to be concerned with anything, to be unconcerned with anything that's going to happen more than 3 years in the future. Because our ability to forecast more than 3 years out in anything to do with the economy is abysmal.
That's true.
But that's the best thing I can say about it.
It's not irrational to say I'm not going to think more than 3 years out. However, we as humans have changed our rational mind. It is impossible for you to think of and conceive of a number larger than 7 without grouping them together. If you think of 8 ants holding still or 8 peas
I can see them.
Only if you group them.
In two groups of four.
What I'm saying. So we cannot conceive of that, and yet we are able to deal with larger numbers because we recognize that we group these things. We start thinking, all right, here's how we think. If we don't change the way we make our long-term decisions in the same way, we have to recognize that we need a different way of looking ahead. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, as long as and there's a lot of wisdom in that. Fortunately, we make a pretty good living exploiting the fact that
exactly.
People don't do it very well.
If everybody takes our advice at this point when we're telling to think differently, then we'll go out of business because what we do for a living.
You know, one of the things, and this does bring up something else, and it relates to all this other stuff. I mentioned the fact that the poor are getting poorer and the rich are getting richer in the United States, which, by the way, is exactly what Strauss and Howe in their book Generation said will be happening at this point, which will reverse itself very nicely in about 15 years. But here's another interesting thing is that AMR, which is a bankrupt company, used to be American Airlines company.
How many times has it been bankrupt?
Once.
I think it's been bankrupt. Well, not as AMR, but American Airlines has been bankrupt.
They only went bankrupt once. and they don't exist anymore. AMR doesn't exist anymore. It's now called AAL, I
right.
think.
Well, if you just keep changing your name every time you go bankrupt, it's only once.
It's only once. It went bankrupt that one time. Other airlines went bankrupt, and that's what you're thinking about, I think. Anyway, they were the last one to go bankrupt, and they went bankrupt in their original bankruptcy court declaration. By the way, they just came out of bankruptcy. AMR said it was their labor costs. They had the highest labor costs in the airline industry. And they are spending, I think, $1.3 billion a year right now on their retirees, and they wanted to cut the payments to their retirees. The court said no. Now, that's significant. And why? It's because the company was bankrupted, according to them, and I do tend to agree, they were bankrupted by the fact that they were paying a lot of people who had worked for years, who they had a contractual promise to whom they had a contractual promise, to pay retirement benefits. The court will not relieve them of that because they do have this contractual promise, and under the law, that carries a higher weight than the claims of the other creditors. Now, why is that significant? When AMR was a profitable company, which wasn't that long ago,
right?
Prior to 2001, for example, it was a very profitable company. They offered what were considered at the time to be benefits that were very reasonable to their employees. Their actuaries at the time said, no problem, we can handle this. But actuaries, by definition, work off of assumptions.
Right.
They declared bankruptcy and said, no, we can't handle this. By the way, the reprieve that goes to these retirees who are celebrating right now by the fact that they still get their full medical care, they still get their pay, they still get everything, and they're very happy about this. There's a finite limit to how far that will go because the issue is there's only so much money that AMR has
right.
as a bankrupt company,
right.
and there's no new money being added to the pot. And other airlines, by the way, have, when they have failed, have found their employees suddenly wind up with significant cuts in their wages, in their retired wages. Now, why is this important? Why am I raising this?
It's very important.
A lot of people who are listening to this are cruising along under the assumption that they have their rights, they have their whatever their retirement program is.
Whether that's from the government or
right.
from a pension somewhere else.
And it's going to exist forever just like it is. And yet at the same time, the Social Security trustees have said 2030, I saw another one. It's back down to 2030 now.
Right.
Somewhere around 2030, the Social Security Trust Fund will no longer be able to support the present system, and it needed to be dropped by 25%. The outlays need to be dropped by 25% to keep it viable.
And people, this is a fascinating piece of reference data.
Mm-hmm.
The older you are, the further into the future you think that 2030 is. If you do the math, it's really easy to say exactly how far in the future it is. But most
people, if I'm 85 years old, it's infinitely into the future.
Right. But the reality is that the older people tend to think of 2030 as being way in the future because it was way in the future in their lifetime.
Yeah, it's 16 years from now.
Right. It's only 16 years away. That's not very far.
It's about as far away as 2000 was.
This is going to shake you a little bit. It's how long we've been doing this radio program.
Okay. So when we've been doing this radio program, as long as we've been doing the radio program,
Social Security is set to fail.
Yes. And it gets worse. There is actually a commission that has been convened with congressional approval to study the military retirement system. We are apparently past the point. This was fascinating as I was reading this article. We are actually, this is on the DOD, it's actually on their website about this commission. We are past the point where changing future retirements will keep that system from collapsing.
That means they have to change current
yes.
retirements.
And they have already started, some of the plans that are on the table right now are, as people leave the military at, let's say, 20 years, they get a lump sum.
Yep.
And that's it.
Which I think is a better deal for the retiree if they make the lump sum the right figure and they give a lump sum that can be rolled into an IRA.
Oh, you must be kidding. They want the taxes on that.
Well, see, that's the point I'm making. If they structure this the way that private corporations are structuring, they're changing from this pension plan, you know, the old school method.
Mm-hmm.
I knew a lot of people that were on the General Motors pension plan. Well, they're not there anymore.
I think I know what they're going to come up with, though. And it's going to be a complex set of choices.
Yeah. If they did what the private companies are doing and converting those things into 401ks, I think it would work great.
They're doing that. The other side of that proposal is reducing future retirement annuities. They're not talking about eliminating them, but reducing them
right.
In return for a higher contribution to the TSP.
TSP is the tax savings plan. It's the
equivalent
of
thrift
savings plan. It's the equivalent of a 401k, only it's for the government.
Yeah, it's a bland government-run 401k.
I think they should match people's money going into there instead of putting the annuity put together. But
that's what they're saying. They're going to be matching up to a certain point, and then they will reduce. Now, here's the problem with this. They did this in England. They basically eliminated the equivalent of Social Security or chopped it by 50%, the amount of that people would get in their equivalent of Social Security at retirement.
Right.
And they gave them the other 50% to invest however they wanted to invest it.
This is
they couldn't
thing.
Take it out, but they had to invest it.
Very, very similar.
And people made terrible decisions with it.
This is the thing that we are very, very much in agreement with the concept of. George W. Bush tried to get part of Social Security privatized. It was thoroughly stopped. When the British did it, we thought, wow, they're doing this. This is amazing. But then a lot of people made really, really stupid decisions in the market.
And a lot of brokers became very wealthy.
Right. A lot of brokers made a lot of money. A lot of the investors have a lot less money than what they started with.
And a lot of people who ran funny investment schemes made a lot of money too.
Right. So we're sitting in a position here in the United States where a lot of people invest, and the people that do invest tend to make some research decisions on how they invest. If everybody, and even that, there's a lot of problems with. We mm-hmm. see a lot of people that come in that have made poor decisions in their investments.
It makes a good living for us.
Right. Well, I mean, we can turn around and say, all right, here's how we would make this better.
Yeah.
If, you know, we've been discussing this most of this episode, if the majority of Americans were now given the opportunity to invest the money that they get, I think that's a great thing. But without education, without limitations.
And therein is the problem.
They would make a lot of very bad decisions.
And it's a fascinating thing. The choice that was made, which was pushed, by the way, really, really hard by the brokerage firms and the investment firms and the insurance companies.
In Britain.
To turn over half of Social Security, the equivalent of Social Security, to just the average person and tell them they can invest it wherever they wanted to. Within certain limitations. Very much like a 401k, very much like an IRA today. But you just flat could not take it out until you were – basically, they restricted withdrawals,
right.
Just like you do on a 401k.
Yeah.
And here is what happened. They did a terrible job. They tremendously enriched the brokerage and the investment industries, and that was a key in the decision to eliminate all commissions in the brokerage industry, 100% elimination, which occurred in 2012. At the end of 2012, actually, in Great Britain. And if we were ever get such a thing here, I suspect we would find. But here's the biggest problem with that decision to give the money to the people to invest. They did such a terrible job of investing that they literally were hitting old age and now here's the key, starving. They could not live on half of their Social Security. And so the government had to put elderly people on welfare and replace their Social Security that they had wasted into the brokerage industry.
Now, I believe wholeheartedly in personal responsibility. I do. And the first caller last hour talked about work ethic and how we need to encourage better work ethic and so on. A part of that, a subset of that, is educating people so they know what is in their interest, what it is that they're doing. Because most people,
but that's
even people that are listening to us right now, when it comes to investing, if, and I have asked this to people for years, I ask them when they come in, what's your background in investing? And people that have been investing for 30 plus years will tell me, oh, I don't know a whole lot about investing. And most people say that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. I could say I don't know a whole lot about investing, even though I've been doing this my entire adult life plus some. The reality is that you'll never know a whole lot about investing if you keep knowing more that there is to know.
But there's certain basics that if you do understand the basics.
Exactly.
But people don't. And this is a.
Those are the key points.
You want an issue, folks, who happen to be listening to this, if anyone is listening.
I'm not.
By the way, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And one of the issues that I have written about and continue to write about is that we have a fundamental flaw in our education system. Our education system has become ossified, which is a nice word of saying it can't move.
It's made out of bone.
And we insist that people take Algebra 2, although in the state of Texas there's a bill to say you don't have to take Algebra 2, but if you don't take Algebra 2, you can't graduate as a distinguished student or something. Like, okay, Algebra 2 makes you distinguished. Okay, anyway, we insist people take Algebra 2, even though, very frankly, most people don't use it. Colleges insist you have Algebra 2 to get in most cases. But we don't teach people investment theory.
Well, I think there's nobody available to teach it at the high school level.
Oh, it can be taught. I mean, it's something that if the teachers...
They would have to learn it.
If the teachers were to learn it. But here's the issue. The teachers all have a defined benefit retirement program. Very few people have a defined benefit fire program. Basically, the defined benefit retirement program is almost exclusively listed to government employees because they have an unlimited ability to take our money and
just
pay
keep
their retirees.
Raising the taxes.
The fact is that until we can convince the education system, and it would take years for this to take place, to treat the issue of managing a person's own retirement investment portfolio with the same seriousness that we teach all the other subjects, although I must admit some of the subjects we don't do very well on, like English and math.
Well, I mean, the concept here is clear in my mind. The state has taken over sex education. They have said that in the area of procreation, we will teach your children, about the fundamentals of more humans being created.
Right. But we don't teach them about the fundamentals of investing.
Right. So,
but we expect them to fund their own retirement
and in somehow get success through it.
I can tell you that when it comes to instinct, the procreative,
that it kind of happens on its own sometimes.
You can wind up with kids.
Yeah. And they go, oh, it must be in the water. I don't know what's going on here.
But the thing about investing,
it doesn't generally happen on its own.
It's like driving. It's counterintuitive.
Yeah.
And it's something that needs to be taught if we're going to allow people to take responsibility for something. For whatever it's worth, rambling around on this subject, retirement is new.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mid-20th century, we had this concept of retiring that came up. And the reason it came up, this is fascinating. I just did the research on this. During the Depression, economists came up with the idea of having everybody retire. And there's actually lots of documents on this. It's not something I've just pulled out of space, okay?
Right, right.
For the purpose of freeing up jobs for younger people. There was a shortage of jobs. So the concept was, I'm very serious. In the 1930s, there's a lot of propaganda that was put out by the government. It is your patriotic duty to take your Social Security and retire at 65. And it was your patriotic duty because there was a shortage of of jobs and an abundance of workers, and young people couldn't get jobs because the old people were in the jobs.
Right, and most of those jobs didn't require a lot of education to get into, but
right.
the employer is not going to hire or fire somebody that's been with them for 30 years just to hire somebody that really doesn't know what they're doing.
And it was a big propaganda move, big push by the government. And for us, we just assume, okay, when you're 65 or 67 or something, you retire.
Right.
The odd thing was, before the New Deal, that was not, it's not, you go back and look at the literature, you go look at everything, the concept of retiring, you didn't. Now, if you were one of the trust babies that you were talking about earlier,
right.
who's independently
ultra,
wealthy, you don't talk
wealthy.
About retiring, you just lived a life of leisure. But the concept of living a life of leisure beyond a certain age for everybody is so, it's something that we created out of whole cloth less than 100 years ago, and we so accept it today that we think it is our inalienable right.
Yeah, the concept of pension and retirement actually comes from nobility. The word pension, that comes from being put on a stipend, being given a bit of income to take care of your living expenses because you were owed it for your family or your blood or some noble thing that you did for somebody that did have family or blood.
I have blood.
I also have blood, but okay. Our blood is red.
Those and blue,
they're
blue-blooded. Oh,
yeah,
they're blue-blooded. Yeah, that's it, right.
Yeah,
okay.
So that concept of retirement is something we now have that as our responsibility. Not only that, we kind of look at it as a right that everyone in the United States will eventually get to a point where we have the right to retire.
And
that's something that is new.
And we're not well prepared for it.
We need to get prepared. This is something that there needs to be some easier things to help educate.
We were totally unprepared for it. And then we got prepared. The teaching system runs a little behind the power curve. The education system, a little.
yeah.
In the education system, the assumption is the government will take care, or the corporation will take care of you when you retire. And so we don't have to teach you anything. Anyway, enough of that. We got to play some commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number's in here if you want to call on the other side of the commercials, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
We'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Where the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And today is Saturday, April 19th, so where we are, and if it's the same date where you are, you can give us a call in here. We didn't even mention the fact that the stock market measured by the S&P 500, Dow Jones, et cetera, is up about 2% the last week, which kind of brings it back up to where it was not very long ago and erases some of the losses and is percolating along nicely. But here's the good news on a bigger issue across the board. In the last quarter, in the first quarter of this year, workers' average wages rose, now, in real terms. And you think, ooh, well, big deal. Well, no, it is a big deal because they haven't been doing that very much lately. The wages rose not only more, they rose more than inflation, which has been unusual. Normally, they haven't even kept up with inflation recently. That means that there will be more people with more money to spend at some point. The other thing that looks very good, one of the big prime indicators that I watch, is executives at manufacturing firms. Now, service firms are very different. Manufacturing firms, 41% are very upbeat about the future. Well, that's still a minority, but that's an unusual. Manufacturing firm CEOs tend to be rather gloomy people, to say the least. And 41% is a good reading. The reason that is so important is in a manufacturing firm, if the CEO is upbeat about the future, they are willing to spend money well in advance of an event to buy the equipment and raw materials and whatever is necessary to manufacture things. They get very, very long lead times in their orders. You know, for a service-related organization, they can get the order and generally be responding immediately.
Right.
In a manufacturing organization, they sometimes have several years lead warning, which they don't publish. But they get the, you know, for instance, let's say Dell is going to make a bunch more computers. They go to the people who manufacture the components in the computers, and they give them often a warning that goes out a year in advance so they can get the materials together and be prepared to meet whatever specification Dell has. Same thing with cars, same thing with a lot of other things. Another thing that is up, even though housing starts were only up like 1 point something or 2% from last year in the first quarter, in the last several weeks, year over year, the permitting is up 7%.
Yeah, single family starts rose 6%. That is year over year. Over the past 2 months, it's up 9.1%. What does that mean? That permitting, this is a really, really big piece of news, actually. This is, people talk about this and they're like, I don't know why are they even mentioning this? Single family homes have had the largest decline, new ones being made, have had the largest decline out of any of the real estate problems that we've had since the recession. It is the thing people have been waiting to begin their new households. So the households starting rate, people are living with their parents longer. These are things that anecdotally, when you're in your day-to-day life, you look around, you see this happening. The fact that this has been waiting to happen means that these people that have been waiting to make their purchases, waiting to begin their house buying, have been saving money so that they can put a down payment on their house. The fact that it's beginning now is something that we've talked about for, what, 3 years? That it has to start at some point. Once the people get the money together, they're not going to continue to live with their parents forever. It is not something that is going to keep anyone sane. So in March, housing starts increased year over year 2.8%. That is 946,000 new house permits. That's almost a million. That's a pretty good deal.
Of course, the problem, and we've discussed this before, is that productivity is up tremendously.
Right.
And that's part of the manufacturing sector in the United States, so it's very rare that we export houses that we build on site, unless there's a hurricane or something. But that was supposed to be funny. I'm supposed to laugh when I say these things.
There were actually
does not increase
weather.
Our exports. But yeah. But the point is that particular aspect of manufacturing, like others, we're not seeing the hiring in the construction industry that the housing starts would suggest normally would occur, very frankly, because we've become more productive in building houses. We were talking about this a long time ago, that a much smaller number of people in a shorter period of time can build a house than they used to in the past. And
well, this one last number fits with that.
Right.
Exactly. If we look at a 5-month moving average, which is a really, really good way of taking out all the things like hurricanes or winter weather or any of that stuff. So 5-month moving average, we're at the highest rate of new home growth, new home starts.
Since what, 2008?
Since July of 2008.
Yep. And I didn't even look at the article,
right.
I could tell you that.
Because what that truly means is that recovery in the housing industry is starting today.
Yeah, and I just wrote a newsletter. I don't know when it's, I guess it was going out pretty soon. Anyway, but in there I said, we are on the cusp, we're on the edge of recovering from the recession. And I realized that, the recession was technically over in 2009 because economists measure recessions as over as soon as you hit the bottom. But from my perspective, that's like saying if you're walking across country and you descend into a valley, when you get to the stream, you're out of the valley. No, you're not out of the valley until you've climbed the hill on the other side.
Correct.
And I think it was a Federal Reserve, other people have been discussing how odd it is that the recession has been over since 2009, but people still feel like they're in a recession. Well, duh.
Well, it's because while we may be recovering, we're not in many ways back to where we were before we started downhill.
Yeah, and we're getting there, and we're not very far from it. For whatever it's worth, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, after we adjust for inflation, is when it gets to, I think, about 2050, somewhere right in that area.
Right.
Will actually be as high as it was in the year 2000. So we've been in a secular bear market for 14 years.
Right. Well, this is another point here, and this is a good one. It kind of fits into this whole thing. We just talked about housing starts, and I gave some numbers. It's just under 1 million for a year.
Right.
If we look at growth in population during the time period, you just threw in inflation to get the S&P 500. If you look at growth in population, mm-hmm. we have a significant group of people that have been building up because housing starts have not been keeping up with population growth. It's been building up and building up. Now we have, it's almost like a reserve fund of people waiting to get their houses. I'm going to make a prediction here.
Mm-hmm.
I think by the end of 2015, that number of people buying new houses at the beginning, single-family houses, which is just under 1 million now.
Okay.
At the end of next year, I think it'll be 1.5 million people.
Okay.
And I think it'll be sustained mm-hmm. there.
And I just read a very good article on mortgages. There's two things they require. A good credit rating.
What?
They really do require a good credit
That's
rating.
That's insane. Oh. They're never going to be able to compete with themselves 7 years ago.
Well, the point is, like, a 650, 700 credit rating is really what you need,
right.
Which is pretty stout. And in the vast majority of cases, they're requiring a significant down payment. Now, FHA still is doing 3.5% down payments.
Uh-huh.
But you have to have a knock-em-dead credit rating.
Right.
And I think that is one of the reasons that our recovery has been slow, is people are paying down their debts, improving their credit ratings.
And building up their savings.
Right. And when they get to the point where they can start spending it will probably surprise the heck out of everybody. Right.
This is the point. These are the fulcrums. These are the points in economics that are really exciting, because I got a text yesterday that said people must be really excited with you right now, and I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, you predicted the blue chips were overpriced and the tech stocks were overpriced. Well, yeah, but that's people don't they don't remember what we predict.
No.
Well, that makes it fun for us because we can come back and say these are the predictions that actually turned out. But I recommend that people actually write down the predictions that we're making.
Not only us, but do that for the other people you listen to as well.
Right, and that includes political people. If mm-hmm. they're making a prediction and they're completely wrong, and they're consistently completely wrong,
then they should be reelected.
Right, they should be reelected as many times as possible.
Because they do, and they are.
That seems to be the point. When it comes to this area, this is one of the largest pieces to the leading economic indicators, new housing starts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of thing that we look at when up till now we've had a slow recovery. These are the sort of pieces of news that we look at and we go, wow, this means that the economy may be about to really start going.
Next 10 to 15 years, we're probably going to be in a secular bull market. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Morning, Jeff and Jake.
Good morning.
To step back to your earlier comments in the program on the cutting the benefits and pensions on military and
right.
Social Security retirees.
Right.
Jeff had made a comment that he had some ideas, and then Jake, of course, made a comment and never got back to that. Would y'all care to get your crystal balls out and tell us what?
In public?
Tell us what those what's your thoughts on the military cuts might be, and then also you made the comment that they would cut Social Security maybe about 25%. Do you think that would be on just the new recipients, or would that be on the existing recipients?
Means testing.
Well, the point is, the longer we wait to do something,
right,
the more likely existing recipients are to be hit. We had there was a program that came up back in about 2006, 2007, to make some adjustments to future Social Security.
They said nobody would be affected if you were,
right,
you were above the age of 50, you'd be fine.
Yeah, actually it was 50, and then they tried again at 55. Well, if you get 10 years past when they said 55...
then you're talking 65.
And you're going to say, okay, we are at the point right now where we're kind of on the cusp on Social Security. On military, we've already passed it. The military retirement system, as it stands right now, is not supportable. And I realize people don't like to hear that. I'm not saying, I'm not making a value judgment. I'm simply looking at the fact that a lot of people saw General Motors' retirement system and American Airlines' retirement system.
And people that were on those pensions said, well, I was promised this. It's
yes,
true, and you earned it.
I can kind of see what the facts are right now. I was really more interested in your educated guess.
They're going to...
You already said that they would maybe go with a lump sum on the military. He had any other ideas on how they may adjust or...
Sure.
That military pension?
Chuck Hagel presented the solution starting immediately for retirees. It was turned down by Congress, but the veterans groups and the generals and everybody else jumped on it and beat it to death, which means that the solution down the road is going to be a lot more severe. He simply said, freeze retirements prior to 62, no inflation adjustment. That was the least painful methodology. It was thoroughly beatbound by a letter campaign and an email campaign to Congress to where it just died. It was in the congressional compromise that we're under now, and it didn't survive. And
well, these people in Congress don't have your education and foresight. That's why I asked what you think that would be the solution that they're going to come up with.
Then the freeze is going to happen.
Congress are idiots. They all have that prefrontal cortex that's not been developed.
Well, no, I think they have a wonderful prefrontal cortex. The problem is the leaders in Congress agreed to this. It was us, the people, the veterans and the military leaders in the United States, who smashed this thing. That is very, very poor thinking on their part, but I understand what they're trying to do, and I understand their perspective. But I can also tell you that there will be a solution, and as time goes by, at a minimum, freezing prior to age 62 inflation adjustments. A second, if we wait long enough, they're basically going to say, guess what? We're going to physically cut your military retirement prior to age 62.
This is something.
So the longer we wait, so the answer is it's incremental. But I'm going to tell you, it's going to happen, and the longer it is put off, the more severe the cut will have to be.
This has happened before.
Really, like you were saying, I think eventually they're just going to be forced to cut it.
Yes.
Right.
Anytime they talk about doing it beforehand, you're going to get these special interest groups. I'm not referring to the military as a special interest group, but that's what they are. Basically, in this particular case, they're going to fight it all the way until they're just forced to do the cut.
Right. I think I know what's going to happen.
They're going to be forced to cut it.
I think I know what's going to happen. The highest probability, and it's not pretty. And that is, we're going to go about another 15 years with the system essentially unchanged, because there's so many people who are pushing it. We're probably going to get into something in Europe along the way where we have to increase the size of the military, which will exacerbate the problem. And about 15 years from now, if we follow history, and again, it's this in this book, Generations, and a lot of other places too, we're going to have a socioeconomic crisis. We have one about that point every 100 years. And that socioeconomic crisis will cause a rethink of everything. And as I have reminded people who insisted that their military retirements were sacred and could not possibly be touched, I said, have you ever heard of Cox's Army? Have you heard of Cox's Army?
I don't believe I have.
It was military retirees, unknown numbers, huge numbers, marching on Washington during the Depression.
92, the bonus right. army invades Washington, D.C. That's what I was meaning when I said this has happened before.
And they were promised money.
This is World War I veterans.
And they didn't get it because the United States couldn't afford it. And frankly, I suspect they did it. We tend to repeat history. And that's why I tell people who have military retirements today who are under age 62, they really should be investing in an IRA or something similar every penny they get in their retirement.
Pile up the money.
And because that's really, you know, that's what they should be doing with it.
Yeah.
They're getting paid a retirement while they're still working.
Yeah, this is something quickly, we're almost out of time. I don't know what the solution the government's going to come up with, but what Jeff Old Baldy, my father, just said is a solution that will work for individuals. Those of you that are in this boat, you see the water is filling up. We're telling you about it. Don't ignore the fact that your feet are getting wet. Take a moment to say you are being given money that may go away at some point and do something with it for your future. Just because it says you're in retirement, retirement doesn't mean that your money has to stop working for you. So anyway, we're about out of time. Thanks for the call. We're available for conversations during the week. If you'd like
consultations.
Yes. If you would like to call us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
947-1111. There's actually live people there during the week, though.
Right. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and on that page you can contact us through a little contact us button. It's pretty amazing. And you can listen to our podcasts and hear further rantings and ravings of two bald men. You can also email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And I'm going to hand it back to you to close off.
Well, it's been a good week in the economy. We got a lot of good positive things for the future, but we all need to be thinking about well on out there what we're going to do about our investments, and I think it's critical. But until next week, you have a good time. Enjoy your Easter holiday, and KTM, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.